Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Everybody, welcome to the Arkham Files, usually your actual play Call of Cthulhu RPG podcast, but we are lucky enough today to bring you another edition of our Arkham Files dossiers, our interview series where we sit down and have cool conversations with interesting people from the gaming and geekdom world. I am Alex, your usual host and keeper of arcane lore, joined here by my co-host, Pete.
Hey, everybody.
Also, sometime keeper, but probably better known as Dom Drunkard from our show's main storyline. And I'm very pleased to announce our amazing guest today hails from what I'm guessing is his secret lair in Sherwood Forest, since he says he lives near Nottingham, England. He's being cagey about it, but seeing as how he's in the area and that he's also a legendary hero of the people, I think we're onto him. From there, he robs from the rich talents of his own pool of creative wealth and gives it out to us poor gamers who are always starving for our next handout of incredible tabletop entertainment. He is a writer and game designer who has won more awards than I care to count. Literally, I stopped counting at like 7 because the list just kept going and going. And that's just since he's been working at Chaosium, where he is currently the creative director for the Call of Cthulhu tabletop role-playing game, the one we all know and love. He's also the commissioning editor and lead writer for the whole line and has guided the development of the entire series since 2013 with over 40 books to his credit. Previous to that, he won even more awards, working on the Warhammer 40K RPG at Games Workshop, where he co-authored Dark Heresy, as well as being commissioning editor and developer on numerous other titles and products in that series. I am incredibly pleased to welcome fellow horror movie and ghost story aficionado and feline subjugant, the one, the only, Mike Mason. Mike, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, of course. I really appreciate you making the time. It's awesome to have you here. Really excited to talk to you. So just to kick things off, can you tell us a little bit about your background? What initially sparked your interest and how you got into tabletop gaming?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this going back in the mists of time.
We love the origin stories.
Sort of back in the late 1970s, I knew nothing about role-playing games. I loved games. I loved board games.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was all, like, that's the only games I knew. And a friend was having a birthday party and invited me to his birthday party. And I was kind of expecting, you know, the kind of typical birthday party that, you know, I'm trying to think how old I was, you know, eight or 9 years old.
Right.
And I turned up and it's literally everyone's in his kitchen around the table. And it's him, me, another friend, and then his older brother and his older brother's friend as well. And they're sitting around this table with these books and this, what I would now tell you is a floor plan, you know, cardboard floor plan with miniatures right. on it. And I said, well, what's this? Oh, we're playing Dungeons and Dragons. I had no idea what that was, but it looked cool. The miniatures looked really cool. And we rolled dice. I mean, I didn't, no idea really what I was doing other than there was lots of skeletons and we were beating them down basically and grabbing treasure, and it was loads of fun, and we just kept playing until his older brother's friend, who's the one who was running it and owned all the miniatures, said he had to go home, and we all wanted to carry on playing, so we managed to persuade him to leave all his stuff so we could carry on playing. And that was my first kind of experience with it. And I was hooked immediately. I just thought this was the best thing ever. And particularly, I love the miniatures. They really kind of were a really focal point in terms of being able to kind of, watch the game unfold before me. And it really mm-hmm. helped. And it wasn't long after there, then I kind of like said, well, this, you know, where do I get this thing called Dungeons and Dragons?
Right.
I discovered there wasn't a game store in the town that I lived in, but the next city along, there was, like, kind of, I don't know how I found out, but I maybe word of mouth found out there was a shop that had all this good stuff, and managed to persuade my father to drive me over to the city to, you know, pick up the basic D&D set then. And and I haven't really looked back since. I mean, that's how I started.
That's awesome. It's so funny. Like, I want to see if I can find the very first older brother that discovered Dungeons and Dragons, since it seems like that's how all of us got introduced to it, was our older brothers or somebody's older brother somehow showed up with this mysterious game. I want to find where that first older brother and what legendary figure he is.
Yeah, this kind of unknown hero, isn't it?
Right. That brought us all into that. So it's just, like you said, just kind of been downhill since there. You got hooked as a kid. And did you just play consistently through the years?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, when you're, that age, you have all the time in the world to game. And mm-hmm. and we did. Even to the point when, I went to the upper school kind of thing, I was in the rugby team. And about half of the rugby team also played D&D. So we would meet awesome. On a Saturday morning, play rugby matches, and then go and have a shower, and then meet round one of our houses and play D&D all afternoon kind of thing. It was just part of life. And that carried on through school. I ended up, when I went into into our sixth form, the kind of, just pre-college, I guess you'd call it, there wasn't a role-playing club at school, so I set one up. And had loads of people turn up every week to run games and play games and so on. So the only time I had a break was really when I went to university after that. I kind of, I did a degree in theatre studies and drama. And I did actually approach the role-playing club at the university I went to, but I wasn't particularly impressed.
Yeah.
So I didn't go back. And so with me doing a drama degree, I kind of did a lot of role playing every day of the week anyway. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really miss it. And it wasn't until I left university and then kind of got back in the real world that I kind of had the pangs to kind of pick it up again. And literally, a few weeks after leaving university, I kind of started playing again. You know, I had all my old school friends still around, so we just kind of carried on. That was really the only break for me.
Yeah, that's cool. It's interesting that you studied drama at university. It's I've been wondering, and it seems like it's pretty consistent with a lot of, you know, people in our circles, that they go into one of those fields. Do you feel like that was something that was, were you always interested in that, and that is something that fueled your interest in role-playing games, or do you feel like the role-playing games kind of kicked off your interest in drama?
It perhaps did a little bit, but the truth of it was, I was well into Call of Cthulhu before university, and I remember actually going to have a chat with the head librarian of this of the university library, to thinking about a career in being a librarian, and that was purely because of Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah,
and kind of between awesome. That, between there, and actually thinking about what I wanted to do, I kind of figured out no, that's not what I actually want to do. I actually want to do something more about communication and so on. And so so that's what, you know, so I already had an interest in drama anyway. I'd been doing productions at school and all that kind of thing, and community production. So that was kind of ran parallel to my, you know, gaming as well, you know, and there's a lot of crossovers, you're quite right. But they were in a sense separate things in my head at the time.
Right.
And so I went to pursue drama, and but it's been certainly a bunch of transferable skills that I got from doing drama that I've incorporated into not just gaming, but most of my working life, to be honest. Because at the end of the day, it's all about communication.
Right, and, for sure. Communication and telling a story.
Yeah.
You mentioned Dungeons and Dragons was kind of your gateway into gaming, and then just barely you talked about how you were into Call of Cthulhu before you got to university. When did you start to kind of explore more games in addition to Dungeons and Dragons, and when did you find Call of Cthulhu?
It didn't take long. I mean, I played D&D a lot for quite a few years, but it wasn't long. I mean, I guess you've heard of the White Dwarf magazine that was a role-playing games magazine in the UK at the time. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't long before I started picking up copies of White Dwarf. And as soon as you open that, there's a lot of D&D content, but you're exposed to Traveller and RuneQuest and all these other kind of games that were popping up overnight in the late 70s, early 80s. And so very quickly, as the kind of the kind of expanded community of role players that I knew in terms of the people at school and their family and brothers and et cetera, somebody would rock up with, you know, the Traveller box set, you know, and we go, well, that looks cool. What's that? And you know, you get into a game, and so very quickly we were always still kind of playing D&D, but we would always go off and try, you know, played Traveller for some time and RuneQuest for some time, and they were the big three, that kind of kept us going for some time, and then Call of Cthulhu came out in 1981. Mm-hmm. It was probably to the end of about, you know, 1982 by the time it kind of traveled across the Atlantic and got into the hands of, you know, my group of friends. And it was a friend of mine, a different friend, who actually had some Call of Cthulhu books. And he was showing me them at school, and I was blown away by the covers. The Tom Sullivan kind of covers to the Asylum and Other Tales and Shadows of Yogg-Sothoth. And I just thought the covers were fantastic. And he was saying, I didn't know anything about Cthulhu. No idea what it was. He just said it was a kind of mystery, kind of horror-y kind of game. And I've always loved horror stories and films and books. And so that kind of really rang a bell in my head, thinking, oh, a horror role-playing game. I've not seen one of those before. That we'll have to give this a go. And so we started playing, you know, I started as a player playing Call of Cthulhu. And actually one of the earliest things we did was we played through Masks of Nathotep. We never finished it because we all died horribly, near the end. But it was a great experience. And again, pretty much as soon as I started playing Call of Cthulhu, I was completely hooked, more so than when I started D&D, because, as I say, I like fantasy stuff, but I love horror films. And so this was like my absolute juice. So I was immediately into that. And so I picked up the books straight away. And started running pretty much straight away. I played a few games initially, but then just kind of overnight, I kind of just became the default, you know, GM keeper for Call of Cthulhu in our group.
Right.
You know, somebody else ran D&D and all that kind of thing. But people just kind of, well, no, you do the Cthulhu. You're quite good at that, apparently. So that's what that's what I did. And it wasn't long before, you know, I just started writing scenarios because, you know, and role-playing is a very creative hobby, isn't it? There's most of us have a desire to kind of write our own stuff. And it was just a great excuse to regurgitate all these horror films I've seen and just turn them into Call of Cthulhu plots, you know, without too much work. And right. And so that, yeah. And then, you know, we were playing D&D, Call of Cthulhu for, I'm trying to think, 10 years on nonstop, really, with that group, just playing anything that came out and homebrew stuff. And yeah.
That's cool. That's awesome. I love to hear about those long running games where, you know, groups of friends that have been just playing for years and years or decades even.
Sure. But, I mean, we had to change characters every other month because you'll get dying. So that was fine, you know.
Right, of course. Yeah, you know. So at what point did you transition from being, you know, just aficionado and player into the professional realm? Like, how did you actually break into the game development, game design industry?
It was fanzines is where I started. Fanzines and conventions is where I started. And the convention started just a little bit before. So I knew some people who actually ran a games convention. And so I kind of helped out, you know, I would come along, not really help run the convention, I'd just turn up and run Call of Cthulhu games. And so I got a little bit of a name for running Cthulhu games. You know, people would come back and want to play again. And I really enjoyed the convention experience. So I started to go to other conventions as well, running Call of Cthulhu. And it just occurred to me, wouldn't it be cool if there was more Call of Cthulhu games at a convention, but I can't run them all. So I can't remember how I did it, but I managed to find some other Call of Cthulhu keepers, convince them, why don't we kind of work together and we'll offer a suite of Call of Cthulhu games at this convention. And I started this thing that was called the Cult of Keepers, which was literally that, a bunch of Call of Cthulhu keepers. We'd go to a show, we'd run loads of games and
have a cult.
and that kind of turned into that we would all write our own scenarios. And kind of the deal was with the Cult of Keepers is we'd go to a convention, you'd run your own scenario, but you would run another person's scenario from the group as well. So in that way, we got a real mix of scenarios. And also you got to kind of write for other people and play other people's scenarios as well, so which is a kind of a good learning experience. So that was happening already. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking to myself, we're generating all these scenarios that we're only playing a few times at conventions. Wouldn't it be cool if we could share them? And at the time, we'd had in the UK, we'd been really well served with a Call of Cthulhu fanzine called Dagon, which was put out by a chap called Carl Ford, who unfortunately passed a few years ago. And that was a real hub for all kind of Cthulhu play in the UK. And obviously in the US, you had Pagan Publishing's The Unspeakable Oath. And they were both kind of doing similar things in slightly different ways, but both kind of being hubs for the community in the different countries. And about the time that I was thinking, wouldn't it be cool to, you know, maybe send these scenarios off to one of these fanzines, both of those fanzines kind of went defunct. Dagon stopped very abruptly, just kind of overnight, it never happened again. And although The Unspeakable Oath, you know, is still published today, it went through a big hiatus and nothing came out. And it's, you know, to us in the UK, that just seemed like, well, that one's died as well. So because there wasn't a fanzine at the time that I could then go and send these to, I just kind of said, well, if they're both died, why don't I just do one? And it was literally just a case of, well, if they'd have still been going, I wouldn't have done one. I'd have just sent the stuff to them. Mm-hmm. But they weren't. So I just set up a fanzine called The Whisperer, and with the intention to publish these scenarios. And the ironic thing is, I never did publish those scenarios in that. I used, because once I put the word out through various news groups, you know, back in the old internet days, of saying, hey, I'm doing a new fanzine, anyone want to contribute anything? I got loads of material in it, which is all great. So I just kind of filled it up with that. And it kind of worked that I did five issues. It was one issue a year. They were quite big. They were big kind of, you know, near US letter size kind of publications. And they kind of, every issue would grow a bit more. And I did, you know, the first few issues were quite general, but then I did a Gaslight Cthulhu special and a Dreamland special, and a kind of a modern day-ish kind of one as well. And so they did really well, but they, and I say that, you know, one a year for 5 years, more or less. And in doing that, I contacted Chaosium and sort of said, hey, I'm doing this fanzine. I just want to let you know and make sure you're okay. And we kind of had the conversation. They were like, oh, you know, are you going to make any money on this? And I said, no, I'm going to lose money on this. And I mean, that's cool. Just as long as you put the legal line in, we're all good. You just carry on. It's all good stuff. And so that was kind of one of my initial kind of interactions with Chaosium. I kind of had already met one or two people from the organization at conventions. They'd been guests of honor at some UK conventions. So I kind of got to know them a little bit through that. So there was a, you know, starting to kind of establish a relationship. And so by the time I was, you know, into issue three or four of The Whisperer, I was kind of having semi-regular kind of conversations in terms of early email with people like Lynn Willis, who was the line editor for Call of Cthulhu at the time. And so every now and again, Lynn would say, hey, I've got some text that's about something to, you know, something to do with England. Will you edit it? Will you give it a look over and check it's okay? So there was, and you know, nothing massive, but little bits and pieces that I would just help them out with. You know, it wasn't paid. It was just kind of, you know, it was good to be asked. It was like, oh, I'm helping Chaosium. I'm helping the game. That's great. Yeah. That was all I was after.
I got the relationship started.
And that kind of turned into some more kind of bits of editorial work. And the kind of the biggest one I did in terms of a book that you can, you know, still see is the Goatswood and Other Unpleasant Places, which is the kind of the Ramsey Campbell source book for Call of Cthulhu that Scott Panalowski was the main writer on. And obviously that's all set in England. So there's a lot of that Lynn passed to me to kind of give it an eye over and so on. So that was the first big publication that I kind of worked on, I guess. But as I say, I kept meeting up with people from Chaosium at various conventions as we go down through the years, you know, meet Sandy and playing Sandy's games and discovered that Sandy loved horror films. And hey, I loved horror films. Right. And you just start swapping recommendations and you've got to see this film. You've not seen it and all that kind of thing. So yeah. I got to know him and Charlie Crank and so on. And so it's about between issue 4 and 5 of The Whisperer, which would be around about the year 2000, 2001, I was working in the real world doing a real job. But I was a bit fed up with it and I wanted a new job. And I opened up a newspaper and I kind of work in kind of media and marketing and all that kind of thing. And so I opened up the kind of media jobs and there was an advert for Games Workshop for wanting an events manager, which is kind of what I was doing at the time as events management. And I kind of thought, hey, I'll apply. Not expecting at all to get it, thinking this will go to somebody, you know, who's really into Games Workshop. Because I kind of fallen out of love with Games Workshop at the time because I was into Games Workshop when it was a role-playing company. Then it became like a miniatures and war games company, which I thought was cool. I had no problem with, but it wasn't really my thing. I was a role player. Yeah. And I was thinking, well, they'll just know that I'm not really a war gamer and you know, I won't get the job. Of course, I got the job. And moved to Nottingham and, you know, started work for Games Workshop and kind of rediscovered my love of miniatures, which was one of the first things that drew me into all this. And obviously Games Workshop are pretty good at doing miniatures. So that worked out okay. And so I was working at Games Workshop in the gaming industry, although I wasn't in games development and creation. I was, you know, in a sales support capacity, running events and community events and so forth. I guess the next kind of bit of the puzzle is Games Workshop. Well, a chap I knew at Games Workshop, he was slightly higher up than me at the time. He had basically been appointed to basically reopen Games Workshop's old board games and role-playing line under a sub-company called Black Industries. And he was saying, oh, we're gonna redo Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, and one day we're going to get around to doing a 40K role-playing game. And, oh, so that's great. Well, sign me up for playtesting and you know, anything I can do to help.
Yeah.
So Games Workshop released Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay and redid Talisman, the board game, and so forth, and started working and developing the 40K RPG. And I was playtesting the 40K RPG, and I wasn't enamored by what I was getting to playtest. and obviously I knew the people that worked in the role-playing side. And so I kind of went over and said, give them my feedback, and said, I'm not sure this is going in the right direction. I mean, what do I know? You know, it's not for me to tell you how to do it, but I've got reservations, so I'm just sharing them with you. I like this, but these bits I'm not too sure about. And we had a kind of big, deep conversation about it. And I thought nothing more of it. And then a few months passed, and then I kind of was contacted and said, hey, we're recruiting for Black Industries. We need a Black Industries manager because the person that's been doing it, they're leaving. You know, we're looking for somebody. We're not saying you can have the job, but if you want to apply for it, we'd welcome you application. So I applied for that, got that job. Kind of, it was like, you know, I'd opened my mouth and said, well, I think you need to do this and this. And it was like, yeah, well, now you go and do what you said you were going to do. So kind of put my foot in my mouth. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like,
I ended up working at Black Industries, which is an imprint of Black Library, the fiction wing of Games Workshop. And that was a creative role straight in. I picked up the manuscript for what was going to be Dark Heresy, the 40K RPG, and it wasn't finished. You know, I had to finish it, and I had to go through it all and make sure it all worked, you know, kind of thing. So, and I had a deadline of, I can't remember what it was now. I think it was 3 months. It was a hard deadline because obviously Games Workshop works with hard deadlines. I mean, obviously, I'd written for role play before, but not in a, you know, not a 400-page rule book that, you know,
that's a
massive IP property
for writing your own scenarios for your buddies.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a kind of a bit of a baptism by fire, and happy to say we met the deadline and got the book out to, you know, good reviews and good success. So it was we sold 30,000 copies before the day of release in pre-sale, which was the entire print run. So that was really cool. One day after it had gone on sale, Games Workshop announced it was closing down Black Industries and licensing the entire lot to Fantasy Flight Games. So I just launched a very successful game and then didn't have a job.
Right. Yeah, that's something I did want to ask you about. Like, how shocked were you when you did put all this time and effort in and you had a great release, great reception, sold out your pre-sale, and then, right, and then they turned around, 2 days later or so and announced that they're closing down Black Industries. That must have been a trigger.
I kind of knew it was coming, but I didn't know.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I kind of, you know, had a
kind
sense
of a buzz around the office type of thing.
I kind of had a sense that they might go, oh, you've done a reasonable job. We'll keep you around for something else. But no, it was kind of clean cut. You know, we're selling that all off and you haven't got a job anymore, so you're made redundant. So so it was a little shock, but not as big as a shock as it could have been, because I kind of saw it coming a little bit. So I then was, you know, out of the games industry again and went back into what I would call the real world again, outside the games industry, working as a marketing manager in a completely you know, unrelated trade. I was working in training and education, particularly in training people, you know, bricklayers and construction workers and all that kind of thing. So miles away from what I was doing there.
Right.
As I said, over the last 10 years or more, I'd built this relationship with Curzium, and they knew that I ran lots of Cthulhu games, and I kind of knew what I was doing with Call of Cthulhu to some degree. So an opportunity arose. And obviously by then I'd met Paul Fricker, who's my co-writer on the new edition of Call of Cthulhu.
Right.
You know, he was part of the Cult of Keepers back in the day, and we'd kind of kept in touch and so on. So we had just been batting around the idea about, isn't it time for a new edition of Call of Cthulhu? Because the old edition had been out, I'm not sure now, over 10 years, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And we felt it was a little bit creaky and also not very new player friendly. The rule book wasn't really laid out in a very welcoming way. I mean, it was fine for us. We knew where everything was because we've been playing so long. But if you're new to the game, it seemed quite a bit of a barrier. So we've been kicking around those ideas for a little while and talking about, well, what would we do? And, you know, that kind of thing. And we ended up at a convention in the UK called Continuum. And it happened that Charlie Crank, the then president of Curzium, was over as a special guest. And obviously, I knew Charlie because we'd met a few times previously.
Right.
He'd even played in one of our games, and his his son had played in the game as well. And that, so we knew. And so basically, we just colored Charlie, you know, where we had a quiet moment and just sort of said, are you thinking about doing a new edition of the game? Because we'd love to help if that's something you're thinking of doing. And he basically very quickly went, yeah, we'd love to do a new edition of the game. Yeah, we'd love for you to write it. So we didn't really have to sell the idea, really. It was like, it was more kind of, we weren't really expecting him to turn around and go, yeah, go and do it. We just thought—
Another one of those oops moments where you're like, wait.
One of those oops, yeah. And so we kind of agreed that, okay, well, me and Paul will go away. We'll go and do something. And we've no idea how long it's going to take us. But when we've got something to show you, we'll show you, and then we'll have a conversation. So there was no deal, there's no contract, there was no talk of money, no talk of deadlines. It was just, we have an idea, we'll go and do something, and if it ends up being something, you can then say yes or no, basically. Yeah,
right.
No pressure.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So then for 4 years in our part time, so I was doing my day job, and then in the evenings, talking to Paul on the phone every other day about, you know, what do you think about this, and discussing rules and outcomes and so forth, and writing, and him writing and checking his stuff and him checking mine, and, you know, this kind of rotating kind of workflow going on for, you know, 4 years, you know, on and off. You know, we've played with us both playtesting things, you know, with our groups and whatnot. Mm-hmm. By the end of 4 years, we had something that was like a rule book. At that point, we kind of got back in touch with Charlie and said, do you still want it? And he kind of went, yeah. And so we sent it over to Charlie, and then that's when we started to get into playtesting and feedback, and it went out to a few people, you know, kind of, you know, friends of Curzium, you know, Call of Cthulhu writers and so forth, and they sent their feedback in. Some loved it, some hated it, some were kind of 50-50. Mm-hmm. and we kind of refined things with, you know, with the guidance of Charlie and so forth, and that kind of feedback, until we had a kind of a game that looked very similar to what we have now. And that's when I basically instigated a kind of a worldwide playtest. So myself and Paul got a kind of a playtest rules pack together, and then we just did an open invitation. If you want a playtest, Call of Cthulhu, get in touch. And so hundreds of groups did, and we sent out the rules and told them, we'll be sending out a survey. Please let us have your feedback. And what was great, pretty much everyone gave us feedback, and it was really useful feedback. It really identified things that were working, things that were more problematic, and so forth, which allowed us to, you know, to refine it further and determine what was going to stay in, what could be thrown out, and so forth. And then, you know, finish it off, basically, to the point that it, you know, could be finally handed over to Chaosium as a done deal. And it was kind of, because that obviously Chaosium were doing a Kickstarter, and and we were just, you know, we were just the writers in my, you know, we weren't employed by Chaosium. We were just throwing in ideas for the Kickstarter to try and, you know, get as many backers as possible, but we weren't really involved. And it's Kickstarter successfully. And one of the rewards of the Kickstarter was there was a certain high level that if you paid X amount, Chaosium would fly me and Paul to Gen Con, and you would play in one of our games, basically.
Cool.
And that was, you know, that was kind of our main reward, really. we rocked up to Gen Con and we ran these special games, and that was all wonderful. And it was at the Gen Con, Charlie turned around and said, well, we haven't got a Call of Cthulhu line editor. I think we kind of need one. Now we're going to do a new edition. Would you like to be it? And so I kind of, you know, thought for about one microsecond and went, yeah, good
one. Right, yeah.
That would be kind of my dream job, wouldn't it?
See you later, regular job.
And by chance, I mean, I don't know, it might be just Charlie feeling sorry for me, but the job I had been doing, that firm had actually just been sold as well. Literally like a few weeks before Gen Con, had been sold. And so everyone in the company was made redundant. So I didn't actually have a job when I went to Gen Con. So it was maybe Charlie throwing me a lifeline. I don't know. But certainly they did need someone to help shepherd the line at that point anyway. So kind of lucky coincidence. So I was able to kind of, you know, take that on.
I mean, you say that Charlie throwing you a lifeline, but after you just delivered this huge product and you got this Kickstarter off the ground, he probably, it seems more like he would have been crazy to not lock that down.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's some truth in that too. Right, but it was very, cool. You know, I was very fortunate in that regard. It was, you know, I'd gone to Gen Con expecting to run some games and come home, and that was it. You know, and that was it. You know, maybe we'd approach Charlie maybe write and, you know, some scenarios down the line or something like that. Was literally where we were with it, and then, you know, came back with a new job basically. So that was all, you know, cool. and kind of I've been at Chaosium ever since, to be honest. So
So when you guys were, you and Paul, you and Paul were the primary writers, and obviously from what it sounds like, and, you know, getting that seventh edition up and running. And you talked about your time with your, you know, working on Dark Heresy as being kind of your baptism by fire. This sounds like it was a little bit more casual of a project, but was there also a little bit of that element too? I can't imagine that there wouldn't be any trepidation on, you know, stepping into the shoes of like a legend like Sandy Peterson to try and update his rule system for Call of Cthulhu, which is probably the second biggest role-playing game in the industry. You know, it's been around for 30 years. What was it like stepping into those shoes and trying to take on a big task like that?
Yeah, I mean, it was somewhat nerve-wracking. I mean, the what was kind of good is because we had this new edition and we had to kind of get it out for the Kickstarter, there was a big pressure to get it out and to get it and do it right. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot of time to worry about everything else. It was kind of, we've got to get all the typos out of this and we've got to clean it up and we've got to get art commissioned and And Chaosm had, in their wisdom, had put all these stretch goals on that now also needed to be delivered. So even though the main bulk of writing on the book had been done, there's still a lot of work to do to finish a book off. But things like, you know, Pulp Cthulhu had been added as a stretch goal, and that didn't exist. There was nothing. So
right. Classic salesman selling products that they don't have yet.
Finished the rule book as much as I could. I was starting to work on, right, what's Pulp Cthulhu? And, you know, determining what that book would be and so forth. So there wasn't a lot of time to sit around. In fact, there's not been a lot of time to sit around for the last 10 years. There's been,
right.
You know, it's a treadmill to, you know, a good treadmill, you know, but, you know, what's after this book is the next book. And we want every book to be brilliant and great and better than the last one. So it's a, you know, right, you're always sort of striving to try and improve quality across the board where you can. And so it's, you know, a nonstop thing almost. But you know, you just sort of, at some point, you just got to dive in with both feet, right, and hope you can swim.
That's cool. You mentioned Pulp Cthulhu. It's one of my favorite settings for Call of Cthulhu. I've run, you know, several pulp games. How do you, when you're developing something like that, that's a supplement to the existing game, how do you find a balance between making it different enough to where it's, you know, it's a different experience, but still kind of true to the game itself, so that, you know, your players aren't playing something, basically not getting to the point where your players are playing something that's a different game entirely?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really important point. And that's something I'd spend a lot of time thinking about with Pulp Cthulhu, because it would be so easy to turn it into, you know, a game that's very action orientated but doesn't feel like Call of Cthulhu. And so it was a case of trying to pin down, well, what is the heart of a Call of Cthulhu story? And the heart of a Call of Cthulhu story is often the horror and a mystery for Call of Cthulhu. Mm-hmm. And so you can still have a mystery in Pulp Cthulhu. It's just that you get through it quicker, basically. It's kind of understanding the difference between, if you think of Call of Cthulhu as standard Call of Cthulhu as a slow burn, and Pulp Cthulhu is a fast burn, basically. As long as you kind of have that in mind, then you're able to just, and it literally is just tweaking and twisting the dials on Call of Cthulhu, kind of turning them up to 10 and 11 in some cases to make them more, because ultimately it's kind of like when you watch particularly like the first in the Indiana Jones movie, you know, when it first came out when you were a kid and you're already playing Call of Cthulhu, you came over going, that was like Call of Cthulhu, you know, maybe not quite, well, actually the first film, yeah, quite a lot of horror in it, melting faces and
right.
strange rituals and all that kind of thing. This isn't far off from Call of Cthulhu, but it was much more action orientated than most Call of Cthulhu games in my experience. And so really, I just kept thinking of that film when I was writing Pulp Cthulhu, thinking, right, okay, so what would we do different than in the normal one? Well, Indy doesn't muck around. You know, he always makes his library useful. He always does it. So right. The clues became much more kind of obvious, and you have to fight less to get the clues. The clues are more or less free. It's really what you do with them and where it takes you in terms of the journey with Pulp. And so that was a kind of a key kind of flavor difference. But ultimately, you know, Pulp is, Call of Cthulhu is about thinking and then maybe acting. And Pulp Cthulhu is more about just do it. Don't think, do it. Basically, right. is the intention, which is why the kind of the use of the luck points as a kind of an agency for the players provides a little bit of a safety cushion as well, because you can
right.
you know, buy off damage to some degree, or prevent things, or not get damaged at all because you've used luck to beat the enemy in some way when you're doing an attack roll. So it provides that kind of a little bit. It allows the characters to be a little bit larger than life, and to have fate kind of go more in their way more of the time than in normal Call of Cthulhu, when, you know, although you can as an option use luck to adjust dice rolls, luck is a much more precious resource in straight Cthulhu. It's you don't get much back. It, not replenished very often. Mm-hmm. Whereas in pulp, you replenish pulp every game session, you get more of it, you can spend more of it, and you can do more things with it. So it's much more kind of a fluid kind of thing than in standard Call of Cthulhu. And that really is the engine that drives the difference. It allows players to do larger than life kind of things in that regard.
That makes sense.
Really ramp up that Indiana Jones adventure.
I mean, it's like my touchstones were Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom mm-hmm. and the Mummy.
You know,
he's kind of like if a game can feel like those films, then
that's
I think
a success.
You're okay.
Yeah, for sure.
You mentioned with Pulp Cthulhu specifically, that was one of the stretch goals for Kickstarter. So it sounds kind of like you basically were thrown Pulp Cthulhu from, you know, here you go, Mike. Great job on 7th edition. Here's your next project. And we've seen several of those kind of different settings come along, you know, Down Darker Trails, those types of things. How many of those and which ones were you just kind of thrown? Like, hey, here's a project. And how many of them did you were kind of your were you, you know, integral to at least coming up with the idea from the beginning, from conception?
It kind of balances out. I mean, there's Down Darker Trails was something that kind of not long after I started at Chaosium was something that was offered to us because Kevin mm-hmm. Ross is the kind of the lead writer on Down Darker Trails had kind of developed these books and basically came and said, look, I've kind of done them. Would you be interested? And we said, well, that sounds great. Yeah, it's in Wild West Cthulhu. Why not? So some things were kind of opportunities. And then some things were just in the history of games, in the history of Chaosium. So mm-hmm. Gaslight and Dark Cthulhu Dark Ages kind of already existed. And so there was a kind of, well, we can update these and put new versions of them out for Cthulhu 7th edition. And so some of them were kind of natural kind of progressions. And then, like any Call of Cthulhu book, it comes down to, does it sound cool? If it sounds cool, will people want to play it and you know, get it? And so you kind of, you know, it has this little double test of, is it cool? And is it cool enough that you want to buy it, basically?
Right.
And I'm a Call of Cthulhu player. And so I go, well, I think it's cool. I would want to buy it. So I think everyone else would. It goes through little hurdles to kind of whether it's something we can take on and develop. And what you've got to remember is prior to 7th edition and me coming on, there was a handful of years really where there wasn't a lot of Call of Cthulhu releases. Chaosium were not in their best of times financially. And maybe you get one release a year, if that. There wasn't a lot of development on those releases. They were pretty much as is, as delivered to them by whoever had written them. And so some of them were a little varying in quality. Some of them are good, some of them not quite so good, just needed a little bit more time and editorial perhaps. So I was kind of coming in from a position where this really great game that, you know, done really good stuff some years ago, but in memory, it nearly died. There was hardly anything in terms of new out for it. So there was a real desire to kind of get quite a lot of new stuff out initially to kind of just to prove it's not a deadline. And you know, we've got a new edition out and here's some new scenarios that support that. And then it was a case of, well, I take some old scenarios and update them and rework them for 7th edition and get those out. So and then suddenly I'm doing Masks of Nathatep, which is a massive classic campaign, mm-hmm. and getting that back out in, you know, into print and so forth. So it's a real mix of things in terms of what's coming along and what sounds good. And, you know, I mean, from day one, I've been trying to get a new edition of Gaslight out. So for 10 years, I've been trying to get the next edition of Gaslight out. And we are that close to releasing it in terms of it, you know, within the next 12 months that will be out, but it's taken 10 years because of other things come and they get put up the priority list, so it's ever changing, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear about Cthulhu Gaslight. That's definitely one we've been looking forward to. I think Pete's actually currently writing a Cthulhu Gaslight scenario for our show for us to play.
Oh, so, that sounds great.
Hopefully, we'll get that. I'm
a big fan of Gaslight. I always have been. So it's kind of one of my personal faves. So yeah,
for sure. Yeah, and with all this development of all these games, all these different settings. So when we spoke to Sandy, he told us this really cool story about when he was playtesting the original Call of Cthulhu. The sanity mechanics that he'd built, you know, started actually causing the players to become more afraid of the events in the game. And like, as their sanity got lower, the players themselves would then start to try to keep their characters from seeing anything disturbing. They'd have them cover their eyes and hide and flee. He said that was one of the moments when, like, he knew he had something special here, you know, when the rules of the game had actually started affecting the players and the characters in the same way. So over all your years of developing and all this, have you ever had any of those kinds of moments where a rule or a mechanic that you wrote or created really, once it hit the table, just ended up going way better or working just like amazingly once it actually hit the table, or just something that was like had completely unforeseen consequences when it actually hit the table?
Sure. I mean, I have to say, I didn't come up with the rule for pushing. That was Paul Fricker came up with that rule. But when I was,
it's a brilliant rule. I love it.
one of the first people to kind of play test, if you see what I mean. So we were still, you know, we were working together on it, but he came up with the concept. And so I think that one, when I first, you know, told the players about the rule and was running a game, and I kind of said, oh, you failed the role. Would you like to push the role?
Yeah.
And they all suddenly looked really scared. I thought, actually, it reminded me, because obviously I knew Sandy's story about Sandy in that particular game.
Yeah, yeah.
It reminded me of that point when thinking, actually, this is exactly what we wanted, because it's a horror game. Mm-hmm. We want people to kind of be apprehensive about pushing a role, because if they fail it, the outcome is going to be much worse. So it's something to generally, you know, it's a risk.
Right.
And so having the players kind of respond that they did, they understood it was a risk, and they understood they had a choice to take the risk or not, the intention increased, which was exactly what we wanted for a horror role-playing game. So that was really good to see that happening, because it kind of mirrored that sanity experience in that first game. The other rule in terms of that I had a bit more development on was Pulp Cthulhu, where I was looking at luck spends and the different things people could do with luck. And particularly, I really enjoyed coming up with luck spends for the villains in Pulp Cthulhu. So things the keeper could spend luck on for their characters, so the villains. And so there was one rule which is called Lookout Master, which is basically if your top cultist, your head villain in your Pulp Cthulhu game is about to be killed by, you know, the players have, you know, shot him or about to do something, they can spend their luck and use Lookout Master, which one of their minions leaps in front of the villain and not him, you know, kind of thing. And it buys the villain, you know, a little bit more time to get away and so forth. And so when that, you know, book went out, and then I started to hear people using the rule and talking about, and they're telling me how it happened in the game and the players' reactions and then what happened next. It was really these fantastic stories. These kind of really kind of dramatic. Oh, and then you know, we tried to kill the villain, but he used Lookout Master. We couldn't get him, and then we had to chase him, and then we finally cornered him, and we got him in the end. But you know, all this building of this sort of, you know, drama and excitement, and so that was really cool to kind of see that again. The intention behind the rule seemed to be working, and that's ultimately what it's about. Is when you've come up with a rule, you kind of have, you know, you can play test it, but the real acid test is somebody else playing it when you're not in the room.
Yeah, right.
Does it have the same effect?
Yeah.
And that's when you know that hopefully it's doing what you intended.
Mm-hmm. I love that. It is a great rule. It definitely adds that element of that kind of pulp cinematic events, you know, that just ratchet up the drama, you know, like you said, where the cultist jumps in front and saves the villain at the last moment. That's exactly the kind of thing you would see in a The Mummy movie or Indiana Jones or something, and then that stretches out into an exciting chase right after, you know. And also pushing the role. There are a few moments better as a keeper than asking that question and watching the whole vibe around the table just changes. Everybody like tenses up and gets that look in their eye.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they've got to, you know, they've got to want it in a way. And
right.
Sometimes it's inevitable because, you know, they really want to, you know, climb that wall or knock yeah. through the door or whatever. And you know, yeah, we're going to do it, you know. And either way, they, you know, if they roll a failure, it's a kind of, oh, no. And yeah. if they roll a success, yeah, yeah. You get a yeah. kind of a great reaction either way, which is, you know, mm-hmm. at the end of the day, as I always say, you know, it's a game and it's meant to be fun. So anything exactly. kind of is fun is hopefully, you know, working well.
Mm-hmm. And those reactions, when you're the keeper, the reactions are what you play for. It's what makes the game fun, is getting your players engaged and getting those types of reactions that you know, pushing the roll or, you know, gives you.
Absolutely. I mean, I think about, you know, all the kind of gaming war stories I hear, you know, in my life as a, you know, writer and game developer, and even just mm-hmm. as a player back in the day. The stories that people tell about their old Call of Cthulhu story games are always really cool because they're always really dramatic. They're always about, oh, the time we all died horribly, the time we tried to beat up Neelathotep and we got fried. And there are all these times that the players have failed horribly, but the players love it. And that's what they talk about, all their failures, in such a positive way. And it's something I don't often hear about or hear in the same way from, you know, other kind of game systems or other styles of play. You know, I get the kind of, oh, you know, that time we all went into the Tomb of Horrors because we mm-hmm. all died horribly. That's very similar. But I don't get the same kind of war stories. Everyone's got, you know, similar stories, you know, if they play D&D or Traveller or whatever it may be. But I don't quite get the same level of thrill from the players sometimes mm-hmm. when they're telling me those stories as opposed to their terrible failures in playing Call of Cthulhu and so forth.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the most fun things you can get with Call of Cthulhu, which is kind of contradictory to pretty much every other game. When you're playing D&D, you get really invested in your character. You get tons and tons of levels. I've seen many, you know, a teenager. My sons are 14, and they play D&D weekly. But their character dies, and they'll legitimately cry because they are so attached to the character. But on Call of Cthulhu, it's entertaining and it's sometimes hilarious. And so that's one thing that's really cool about Call of Cthulhu.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So with all these years behind you in your professional career and writing and developing, I mean, you guys at Chaosium, you also have a very vibrant community, content creating community over the Miskatonic repository. So you now, if Cult of Keepers Mike was back there working in the Miskatonic repository, creating these scenarios for publication, what advice would you give him?
Sure. I mean, to be frank, I wished it had existed in my day, you know, when right. I had all these scenarios. We just didn't, you know, the opportunities back then were pretty limited. You either mm-hmm. took a chance and sent something to a games company and yeah. you may never hear from it again or whatever.
Kids these days don't understand the tough times before the internet.
The barriers are so low to entry in that sense of if you've mm-hmm. got a design, you've got at least an out of ability to kind of produce something and put it up as a PDF, then, you know, the options are fantastic for people. And that's why, you know, I really embrace the community side, is because I think, you know, ultimately I see it's the next generation, you know, it's how I started. They've just got a little bit more kind of, you know, technology to help them than I did. But
right.
literally, you know, whoever will be sat doing what I'm doing in, you know, well, 30 years time, you know, it's going to probably be somebody who's been putting stuff on the community, you know, at some point and developing their skills. So all these kind of things, just the way that same way I did and the people that did the job before me did. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I'd certainly be making use of the community content program for Call of Cthulhu and getting, you know, my scenarios up there. Probably I'd have probably done that. Everyone told me how bad they were, those early scenarios, and you know, probably never do it again. But that's a learning experience. But I think all these kind of community, and it's great to see other games companies. You know, obviously D&D does it already anyway, but you know, other games mm-hmm. companies are doing similar content programs, which is just great. You know, at the end of the day, it is about, it's a real experience and learning experience for people to kind of really, you know, to get their hands dirty in terms of producing something that, you know, and getting the ability to get feedback from players who pick it up and use it, which is all really valuable when you're, you know, especially when you're starting out. But even now, you know, people give me feedback on my stuff. It's always useful. So.
Cool. Yeah, that's awesome. We are bumping up against the time that we asked for you to hang out for. So we did have one more project that we didn't want to ask you about if you had any extra time.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Because it is another thing that we are very passionate about, but it is shifting gears a little bit too. But yeah, if you're cool with hanging out for another few minutes, we're big movie buffs also here over at the Arkham Files. And so we wanted to ask you about another project you're currently involved in called Fantastic Flops that is over at Kickstarter right now. The project itself, it's a book about misunderstood movies that didn't do so well at the box office, but were fantastic films nonetheless. And we love the idea so much, we actually backed the project at the $135 level. So we might be coming back for fantastic. The Ghost Show podcast soon.
Yeah,
sure. But can you tell us a little bit about Fantastic Flops and how you got involved with that project?
Yeah, sure. Christopher, the editor, the owner of Ghost Show Press, this is the third book he's put together in this way. And I know him through a mutual friend who introduced me and said, hey, because the first book he did was on horror films. And it's basically was a book on, you know,
transgressive horror, right?
Transgressive horror, you know, what horror films had a real impact on all manner of things.
Right.
And so our mutual friend said, Mike, you really need to go and write an essay about Jaws, which is one of my, you know, if not my favorite film of all time.
Yeah.
And so it kind of put us together, and I said, well, I'll try and write something on Jaws. And oh yeah, that'd be great. So I wrote something for the first book, the book on horror around Jaws. And that was started successfully and came out, and it's a great book of, you know, if you're into horror films, fantastic. And then the second book was on science fiction films. I unfortunately didn't have the time, the capacity to kind of put an essay in for that one. Right. So I didn't contribute to that one, but I backed that myself to, you know, because I wanted to get a copy of it. Mm-hmm. And that's full of really cool sci-fi films, many of which I've never seen or heard of. It's really, you know, if you're into these kind of things, they are wealths of kind of information about films that you may have never seen and that you now want to go and see.
Right.
So they're good. Anyway, having done sci-fi and horror, Christopher decided to, the next one would be Fantastic Flops, which was, as you say, kind of films that maybe critically or financially flopped, but actually had a bigger impact or had some sort of influence beyond, you know, beyond them. They kind of, you know, were more than just a flop, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was invited to, you know, to contribute to this one again. And fortunately, I had a bit more time. And I thought, well, why don't I do an essay about The Big Lebowski? Because, you know, what's not to love about that film? And it wasn't a particularly big success at the time, but it's become, you know, almost like Rocky Horror in this sort of cult
kind
of
status for sure.
of the film. Yeah, for sure. And I thought, well, that sounds like a, you know, great thing to write about. So I've written that as an essay for the book, along with, you know, many other people writing about many different kind of styles of films. So that was very fortunate to kind of be able to contribute to that. And looking forward to, you know, seeing that one come out in due course. But thanks for backing it. That's wonderful.
Yeah, we're excited to see it. With The Big Lebowski, you mentioned, it's kind of, when you look at the last 20 years, as far as, you know, cult following goes, it's going to be at or near the top of the list. Did you select The Big Lebowski to write about, or was that, did they have a list and you kind of got assigned Big Lebowski? How did that work out?
Oh no, you always pick your film. So whichever of these books you're writing for, you basically nominate the film. So I would like to write about The Big Lebowski. And sometimes you have a second choice. You kind of go, I'd like to write about Big Lebowski, and my second choice, if somebody else is doing it or you don't want that one, here's my second choice film kind of thing. And as far as I know, I've always been fortunate to get my first choice. So you nominate, because at the end of the day, you want to write about something you have a bit of a passion for. Mm-hmm. So rather than, you know, being told, mm-hmm. that, you know, now I need to go and write about, I don't know, Barbie or something, you're writing about something you've already got an interest in and you know, and, you know, you feel you can say something about, really. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what was your second choice?
I knew you were going to ask me. As I said, I'm now trying to remember what it was. I can't cheat because I won't find the email in time. I'm trying to remember. Oh, yes, I do. Yeah. Okay. Dr. Sleep, the sequel to The Shining, mm-hmm. with Ewan McGregor,
right?
Which again didn't particularly set the world on fire on its release, but subsequently, I found there's a lot of people who've got a lot of love for that film, and mm-hmm. including myself, and it's kind of a little bit of a, it kind of went under the radar a little bit. So that was my second choice. But
That's a good choice. It's a good choice. I also liked Dr. Sleep. I think Mike Flanagan's really one of the best horror filmmakers out there right now.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really know much about Flanagan's work, and the first thing I actually saw was Oculus.
Okay.
I didn't really know anything about the film. I just thought it was going to be another kind of ghost story.
Right.
Not really expecting anything. And then because the way certain things are done in the film, I realized, oh, this guy knows what he's doing. This is good. This is original. I've not seen this done before. I'm now interested. And mm-hmm. And so I've been a bit of a fan of his work as he's gone through, because I think he is bringing something new a lot of the time. And he certainly, you can see, he takes care with the material, and he's mm-hmm. clearly got a love of horror in that sense. So, and so it's not just somebody making a quick book on a horror film. It's somebody who actually is one of us. You know what I mean? He's one of us in that sense that he loves horror films.
Exactly.
And you can see that.
He has a love for the genre, and he's trying to innovate, but also maintain the essence of the genre and keep and retain everything that makes it good and what made us love it in the first place.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's see. Are you a big fan of those types of movies, like the misunderstood gems, or even like the crappy movies that are so bad they're good?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We me and Paul and other friends, we used to get together for a weekend and watch all sorts of horror films and strange films and stuff that, you know, somebody had recommended that, you know, you could only get on some sort of dodgy streaming somewhere, Asian horror film or something like that. And we never knew what we were going to be watching. It was, you know, kind of like, is this actually good, or is it going to be just so bad it's good? And, and they were all of them something along that in that spectrum. So, you know, watching crazy, crazy, weird films and classics as well. Just rewatching kind of classic stuff as well. But No, I mean, you know, there are some particularly bad films that are just fun to watch, aren't they, at the end of the day?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we've had the same thing over the years. We could just called it crappy movie night, where we'd find something that looked horrendous or awful and get together with all their buddies and watch it, you know, riff on it like you do. Do you have any recommendations from that well of amazing cinema?
Where'd you start? I'm trying to think. I'll tell you what I did watch the other night, which is a film I'd kind of heard about but never had the opportunity to see. It's an Australian, it's kind of tends to be called a horror film, but it's more of a thriller kind of dark film called Wake in Fright. I think it's 1971. There was actually a recent remake, kind of television remake in two parts of it, and that's quite faithful to the original film to some degree. But it's about this young Australian teacher in the outback who's trying to get back to Sydney and kind of arrives in this other little town in the middle of the outback, in the middle of nowhere, and one thing leads to another, and he suddenly finds himself with no money. He's lost all his money gambling it, and you know, is at the mercy of the strange townsfolk. Who aren't really that strange. They're just, you know, and he, you know, gets into sort of, you know, from one worse situation to the next, until it kind of resolves. But that was an interesting one. It's not for everyone, because it's got there's one scene, the night scene, when he's kind of forced to go kind of with these kind of crazed people who are going basically shooting kangaroos, and it's quite a graphic kind of hunting sequence. Mm-hmm. That's not for everyone, I would say. The TV version is certainly far less gruesome in that sense. It's still not pleasant, but it's not as bad as the original film in that sense, if you have any sensibility to that. Other than that, I always say something like Primer, because it's one of those films that has flown under the radar for many people, because it's a very low budget film. I don't know if you have heard of Primer, but
I haven't actually.
Okay, so it's a micro budget American little independent film. I'm pretty sure you can find it on Amazon Prime and all that kind of thing. And it's sort of set in the modern day in kind of Silicon Valley, and it's these couple of guys who are basically trying to just come up with ideas for new patents from the garage, basically, and just trying to make some extra money. Right. Kind of thing, and they're doing these kind of, they're quite techie people, and they're coming up with these little kind of things, and they never use the words in the film time machine, but basically they kind of unwittingly kind of build a time machine and then begin to use it. But it's not, you know, it's not like movie time travel where it's all easy and no paradoxes. It's all that. It's basically They can set their time machine and go back a certain amount of time, but when they go back, they've got to wait in a hotel room because their other version of them is still walking around, and so they have to kind of not cross the streams and then there's all these little things you start noticing, like every time these characters are talking, one of them's got an earpiece in listening to something. And that's without kind of giving the plot away, but basically you're not until the end when you start to realize you've been watching all these different versions of them without realizing it. And the primer is they're listening to the conversation that's already taken place, having the conversation again. And it just gets it. And in terms of the actual logic of it, it just blows up in terms of like all these kind of potentials. And there are, it's kind of mind blowing in terms of like weirdness, and I highly recommend it if you're into kind of slightly strange films.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds awesome.
It's really worth a look. But it will blow your mind, and you watch it, and then you want to just rewatch it again to try and understand it, and you rewatch it again, and you still don't understand it, and but you can watch it again anyway because it's good. So
cool. Yeah, I love that stuff. There you go, Pete. Throw that on our list.
I already wrote it down. It's right up our alley.
So. We'll cue it up. Yeah, I stumbled on a little indie sci-fi horror one on Prime the other day that I loved. The Endless. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. That would have been my other recommendation. Yeah. The Endless. It's fantastic. Have you seen the kind of prequel film to that called Resolution?
Oh, I haven't. I was looking up more from those.
Same filmmakers.
That director. Yeah.
They made this just before The Endless. It's called Resolution, and basically you meet the characters in The Endless. So there's a scene in The Endless where there's a guy or a couple of guys in a cabin that they kind of come across. The first film is all about those guys in that cabin. So they're in the same situation. Yeah. But having watched The Endless, you'll probably appreciate it even more because you don't know what's going on with them.
Right.
and The Endless kind of tells you a little bit more. And so they work very well as a pair in that sense because they're all part of the same story effectively. So definitely watch Resolution. It's
awesome. Yeah, I got to grab that because I just found Endless the other day, and so I was like, oh, this is so good. I really loved it.
That great scene when they're throwing a rope up in the air and it's who's holding the rope? I don't get it.
I know. It's good. I know, it was one of those movies that gave me hope that there's you know, there's still indie filmmakers out there that are making these really great, creative, original movies, you know, which there just seems to be a lack of these days. So when I found that, it was really refreshing. So yeah, I'll have to check out Resolution.
And they've done some other crazy weird films as well subsequently. And they're all worth checking out. They're all they're all off the wall in some way. Yeah.
Cool. Well, our last thing on the agenda, Mike, we'll let you go. We really appreciate you hanging out longer here, especially talk about awesome movies, which we always love to do. But we wanted to announce the winner for our Freedom from Boredom contest, in which we are giving away a brand new Nintendo Switch with a sweet custom Arkham Files skin on it, the Call of Cthulhu video game, and also Mike Mason's starter set for the Call of Cthulhu tabletop role-playing game. So, you know, we're trying to get you hooked. We're giving you the all the gateways to get you hooked. And Mike has very graciously agreed to announce who our winner is. So Pete's queuing up our spin wheel here. So whenever you're ready, Pete, let it go.
Can you guys see my screen with the rad spin wheel here?
Yeah.
Absolutely. That looks amazing.
Here we go with the spin of the wheel.
I know you guys have been waiting on this.
And the name's going to be where that little arrow's pointing.
Should just pop up.
It tells me. So you guys want me to tell you who's won?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, well, congratulations to Nicholas Livingston. You have won.
All right, congrats.
Got sweet rewards coming to you.
Yes, we will reach out and get you those fantastic prizes. Mike, thank you so much for announcing our winner of our Freedom from Boredom giveaway.
My pleasure.
Thanks for doing that. And Mike, again, thanks so much for being here on the show. We really appreciate it. That was tons of fun. I could keep going all night.
it's a genuine pleasure chatting to you guys. Shooting the breeze, and particularly thank you for shoehorning in a bit of film talk, which I rarely get to do. So it's been a delight. So anytime you want me back, I'm more than happy. So it's been a genuine a lot of fun. So thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. We're gonna hold you to that. You set in stone. Yeah, love to reach you out. Love to have you back at any time, Mike. So yeah, thanks again. You have a good evening over there in your secret lair, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, you take care. Bye-bye for now. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Arkham Files Dossier Series. Huge thank you to our special guest, Mike Mason. He was awesome. Additional thank you to him for announcing our big winner for our Freedom from Boredom giveaway, which leads me to my next point. Congratulations again to Nicholas Livingston. You have won a brand new mother flippin' Nintendo Switch with a stylish Arkham Files skin, the Call of Cthulhu Switch video game, and last but not least, the Call of Cthulhu starter set written by new friend of the show, Mike Mason. Once again, please visit our website, www.arkhamrpg.com, for sweet merch. Check us out on social media and Patreon at patreon.com/TheArkhamFiles for sweet bonus content. Until next time, don't do anything Alex tells you to do.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.